You're listening to the Overdrive Podcast, Hour 2.
Gord Miller, Dave Poulin here on a sweltering Thursday in Toronto.
I'm not complaining about the heat, ever.
I made a serious misjudgment today, wearing black jeans and a dark shirt while I decided to move some stuff outside. That was an unforced error.
And your official moving company isn't open yet because Blair is not in university. Wait till your moving company opens.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes, because there's a personal side of it that you have to. You don't hire someone to move your daughter into her dorm room in college. And each time she chooses to move, no matter where she's going to school, you are part of the move. And I'm guaranteeing you this. And then she's going to go to graduate school. And you're going to fly into that city, and you're going to rent an F-150, and you're going to go to the house, and it's going to be a third-floor walk-up on a day like this. And she's going to be moving her sofa. I'm telling you, Gord, it's the best. It is the absolute...
And you have twins. And you
I have three.
But you had twins.
Identical
had
twins and a third.
Yeah.
And they move.
So
they move a lot.
So basically what you're saying is the next decade of my life is going to be a living hell.
At least your moving company will stay open until... postgraduate school.
I can just say this. There is nothing in the first 54 years of my life that prepared me to be the father of a 14-year-old girl. Nothing. I have no life.
Do you think there's going to be something that prepares you for a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old?
There's nothing in my life experience that prepared me for this. I consult.
I do consult.
Do you really?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very successful consulting company.
You made a lot of money doing that? One of the things the Leafs were able to do in the Lou Lamoriello era was make people disappear. And it's a long list of course, Robota Island. Brooks Like, acquired from Washington in a trade, played the end of the year. Then the following season, they sent him down to the American League at the start of the year. They said it was a paper transaction. He spent the entire year there. And there were times he wasn't even playing for the Marlies. And Lou Lamoriello was asked, where is he? He's here.
He's here.
Where?
He's here.
But where is he?
He's here.
But he's not playing for the Marlies or the Leafs. Where is he?
He's here.
Right. And that's exactly how it went. And if one of the
well,
others...
they named an island after one guy.
Well, Robota. And then there was the Joffre Loophole case.
Well, let's go back to Robota for a second, okay. Because they said, when asked where he was, they said, well, he's dropping his children off at school.
How many months does that take?
Well, they went to school in Montreal.
Did he walk? and the other one was Joffre Loophole, who, of course, was injured. But Loophole at one point joked about how he failed his medical. The Leafs were never going to pass him. But the other day, he was on the Spit and Chicklets podcast with Paul Bissonnette, Biznasty, and the crew, and had this to say about the end of his time with the Leafs.
It's nothing's really that crazy. I mean, my contract was at that point exceeding my production on the ice, and I was
just
hurt.
For 1 year,
I was,
right?
I was hurt a lot. Like I was like, it was always something. It was back, and then my groin, and then it was. I couldn't keep myself healthy, and also I had lost the confidence, not like in my ability or skill set, but just the confidence in like, am I going to make it through this game? Like, I feel like shit today. Is there a chance that I'm just like going to blow out my back or something? And then, so, I mean, they didn't necessarily want me back on the team that year, and they made that pretty clear. But if I had full confidence in my body, I'm sure I would have put up a big fight and been like, hey, I can't, I don't want to do this. But I, to be honest, I wasn't sure. And you start, at that age, you start getting more thoughts in your head too about like, I don't want to myself up for life going forward. Like I want to have kids and stuff one day. Yeah. And it's like when, as soon as that stuff's in your head and you're trying to play hockey, you probably know a little bit about that with injuries that like linger on. When that stuff gets in your head, you're like, you're not going to be successful. That's kind of where I was at.
Pretty forthright.
It was very forthright. I'm not sure that's exactly what happened. Now, I understand the confidence part. He'd been through it earlier when he was in Anaheim. And essentially, when we made that trade, we were trading for Jake Gardner. And we were taking the Loophole contract.
Right.
And, you know, Jake was at the University of Wisconsin at the time. And Anaheim had a plethora of defensemen. They had Justin Schultz still coming at that point. They drafted all these young D. They had Cam Fowler had dropped into their lap in the draft. And so Jake was available. but then we were also taking Lupo's contract. Joffrey Lupo was a very, very productive player for us for a couple of years. Very productive. And, I mean, he was an excellent hockey player. And the confidence thing that he talks about there, it was after I left, so I never had those discussions with him. I understand it, but I don't really understand it, because he came back the 1 year in great shape, all ready to go. And if you remember, Nazem Kadri saying, it's great to have him back. Yeah. He looks tremendous. And all of a sudden, he was gone.
His back went, right?
Right after. No, it didn't go. He was just gone.
Oh, sorry. He was just...
Yeah, there was no exact... I think the medical said the back, but the day before, he had been skating and training and was in great shape.
That's what he made the comment about, you know, I was never passing that medical.
Right.
And so, you know, and back to the Jim Boughton book, you know, Bowl 4 is a lot about a guy losing his confidence.
Mm-hmm. When you said that about Boughton, that's the first thing I thought of, was because I just listened to that clip before we went on air, and that's exactly what Lupul is saying in that, is that he lost full confidence in his ability to play.
Now, did you battle a lingering injury late in your career, right? You had a...
More in Boston.
Yeah.
And it was a couple of strange things. I broke my jaw really badly, and then I had that groin surgery, and that's the year that I only played 18 games, I believe. And I literally tore the muscle right off the bone.
Right.
And so I had extensive surgery in Vancouver at that point.
Right.
Andrew Seal was doing that surgery when no one else was doing it, that mesh surgery. And once I got that fixed, it was fine. But I went through 2 years in Boston in my early 30s where I struggled to stay healthy.
And part of the problem is, and I think that we misunderstand, you know, as outsiders, that when a player comes back from injury, he's not necessarily healthy. He's ready to play.
It's a big, big factor. I mean, it's a big factor.
And so...
You get to know your own body, though. And I will say, Lupo put a lot of time into that effort of knowing his own body. And as you get to be a pro athlete in later years, you know what you can and can't do. But that confidence you don't control. And you're so... It's almost like standing on the tee box with a driver when you're not sure where it's going.
Do you... Now, Lupo, like players like that, how did you feel seeing them sort of in limbo?
It's tough. And believe me, there were questions, because the cap was a huge issue at that point for the Leafs. And there were other guys around the league who posed the exact same questions in management positions.
Well, Milan McCulloch and others were...
No, but I mean other general managers who were saying, you know, what's going on? I mean, you can't just make players go away. You have cap issues.
They're not invisible.
You can't. Yeah, hence the Robita Island. They're on Robita Island. You can't make players go away in the cap world. It's not the way it works. And yet, that sequence of time, it did happen.
I wonder, too, if it ever comes back to haunt a manager like a Lou Lamoriello, if his treatment of some players ever comes back.
It certainly doesn't seem to, Gord. The guys that play for him love him.
They do.
There's a loyalty in like we talked a lot about Scotty Bowman as general manager, but Lou builds a trust, and I will say, everybody that plays for him, all they're asked to do is play hockey,
and they're asked to perform a specific role. So role players and veteran players loved him. John Madden loved him. Scott Stevens, Marty Brodeur, they also had a voice. Lou gave them a voice to an extent in the room,
but that's where he builds his loyalty. You know, it's almost an us against the world. We're going to do it differently. If 30 of the teams that come into Toronto stay at the same hotel,
they stay
someplace.
If everyone stays at the Westin
or they stay at the Ritz, they stay at the Westin. Yeah.
And the other thing about him is that's fascinating is the rules, the Lou's rules mm-hmm. that will be followed no matter what. And yet players don't seem to chafe as much at it. Some do. Some don't like it, and I think they're silly, like treat men like men. But
but it does give you a structure. I think I would have been a good Lou Lamoriello player.
Well, he'd have loved you.
Yeah, I think I would have fit in well. I would have been a part of it. I had no...
Because you went long times without scoring, you know.
Wow, that was totally unnecessary.
Sorry.
Totally unnecessary. I would have fit that style.
Of
I would have fit. I also think
and
I
your person and your personality would have fit.
I think I would have done good at the Air Force Academy or the Naval Academy or West Point. I think I would have, you know, I think I would have been fine in that environment.
So that's sort of a, I mean, but the idea of players, you know, just disappearing. I mean, he kind of got off the hook on the contract for Kovalchuk too.
Kind of. He totally got off the hook.
Like he, you know, like.
And then on the back end of it, they gave the draft picks back.
Like how does he.
After he was gone, they gave the draft picks back.
He's amazing. And I wonder, but.
He's almost above reproach in many ways. It's one of those situations.
Like, I was gonna say, like, who else could do that?
Well, it's one of those situations that when something like that happens and you ask a question, the answer is, well, it's Lou.
Right. Lou's rule.
Like, that's an answer. It's Lou.
Yeah.
And when you get to that point, almost of invincibility, you're not questioned about
it's
it.
So, I mean, so at one
it's remarkable. It really is. And Scotty Bowman was there, clearly.
At one time with the Devils, they were owned by a group that owned the Yankees, the Devils, and the New Jersey Nets. So they were called Yankee Nets. And Lou was the president of the whole thing. So he's the president of the Yankees, the whole thing.
Right.
So his first year doing that, he's just taken the job, and two things happen. Number one, he puts the rule in for the Nets. You must wear jacket and tie on the team charter. Now, in the NBA, the dress code is much more relaxed. So Derek Coleman, one of the worst human beings ever to play professional sports, gets on the plane wearing his tracksuit. And Butch Beard is the coach. And Coleman hands him a blank check and says, just fill it out at the end of the year. Like, just put the amount in the air. I'm wearing this every day.
Yeah.
But in the playoffs that year, the Nets played Orlando. And in New Jersey, team charters leave from Newark. There's an area of Newark International Airport. So the players are on the plane, and all of a sudden this bus pulls up, this party bus, or a minibus. And it's got all the directors from Yankee Nets. And Lou's like, what are you guys doing here? Oh, we're going to Orlando with the team. We're on the manifest. Yeah, you're not getting on this plane. Let's go. And he literally left the directors of Yankee Nets on the tarmac at Newark Airport and left without them.
And I'm sure there were no resulting follow-up. You get to a certain point where because you've been so successful and you've done things a certain way the whole way through, then it's accepted. Because it's Lou.
Right. And so the funny thing is that people think that he won because the players couldn't have shoulder-length hair or wear jewelry or have facial hair in the regular season.
Yeah. Which, not why they won, but it was a part of the structure and the fabric and pulling them together because they were different than everybody else.
Yeah. So Scott Gomez, one of my favorite people in the game, the human bobblehead. So they win the cup in 03. And so Gomez turns up for the team picture the next year with a thick gold chain on, like this really, like a tire chain he's wearing. And Lou's like, take off the chain. He goes, it doesn't come off, Lou. Look, it's soldered on. Like it's, get the bolt cutters. Cut the thing off his neck. Like who does that?
Lou.
He was at the Stanica.
He's been a highly successful guy doing it.
At the finals in 95, they're playing Detroit. And I sat in the stand, and I like Lou, and I've had a long history with him, and we get along. I love talking hockey with him. I love talking everything with him. They were ripping the microphones out, the NHL Productions microphones from the Devil's bench. Because, you know, they do the video.
And
they
have,
he had the microphones ripped out. And Lou said, what do you think of that? And I said, if I was the league, I wouldn't give you your TV money. And he looked at me like I just stepped on his foot.
How would he handle the producer 24/7?
So what now... Was he the GM of the Leafs? No, he wasn't. When they played in the Winter Classic, was he? No, he wasn't yet.
No,
I've always wondered how he'd react to a 24/7, like because you have to do it if you play in the Winter Classic.
No choice.
So, I guess they just wouldn't play in a Winter Classic.
Yeah, I'm sure he had the opportunity to.
Because
he had the opportunity.
He would not sign like the guy lying on the floor with the camera while the coach is giving the talk. That's not happening with a Lou team.
And they do such a great job of it.
No,
where
they actually
have a guy who's like 23 or 24 years old who does the handheld. He's buddies with the guys. By the end of it, he's like best friends with the players. Like, what's up with that?
They don't even know he's there. But I just can't imagine. Now, in the case of, I mean, you can say all you like. We kind of laugh about the rules and everything else. The way he's treated some players is not like what he did to Brooks Like. He told Like when he sent him down that it was just a paper transaction. He spent the whole year in the American League.
Mm-hmm.
with basically no contact from him.
Yeah, well,
like Lou never called him, never.
Start right back to your Jim Boughton. A lot of the stories haven't been told. Will those stories come out at some point? I mean, that was a pretty high profile one, but.
And you start telling stories about Lou, your curtains are
going to start. Did you hear how I ended it? Yeah. At some point.
At some point. But some guys do like the structure. I think
it is a unifying piece because we're different from everybody else.
I think it is silly to tell grown men that they can't grow a mustache or they can't have shoulder length hair. It's like making kids wear suits to the rink in minor hockey. Like, it's ridiculous. You know, and then people say, well, look good, play good. Well, first of all, go to school, look good, play well. But maybe your kids should go to school longer and play less hockey. But
that suit thing to the rink makes them feel big time.
Well, it does. It's ridiculous what NHL players do. The public never sees them. Like, literally, you can go on a road trip and almost never encounter a member of the public.
I remember Ray Bourque walking onto a plane and he had like a gorgeous handmade shirt on. And it actually had a design down the buttons instead of a tie. It looked great. I mean, it was really a slick shirt. And Milbury was like, you need a tie.
And you told Ray Bourque that?
Oh, yeah. Of course he did.
Mike. Of course Mike
was great.
Of course Mike would.
I just... Yeah, we had a new policy shortly after that. If you had a really nice shirt on, you didn't need a tie. We called it the Bourque policy.
Worked. I think Ray
worked for us.
Yeah, the rules, everyone's equal, just some are more equal than others. But
for us.
I do think that that conformity and that, you know, it works for him. It does work for him.
And how much of it was, I mean, Jersey was a really different place to play.
Well, Moscow, it's called Moscow on the Hudson.
You know?
Like, I remember, they won the cup in 2003. Igor Larionov was playing there. I think it was 2003 they won it when Igor was there. Lou wouldn't let his kids come to the locker room. They just won the cup.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no family. Like, seriously?
Well, that's changed dramatically now. I remember one of the St. Louis Blues this year saying, what took the family so long to get down here? Because they weren't down 2 minutes after the game was over.
And Igor, Igor took on the Soviet Union, so Lou was nothing for him. But Igor, so the other thing Lou does is in the playoffs, the team stays in a hotel at home.
That's the old Montreal Canadiens.
The night before home games. So these guys, and they used to stay at this awful Marriott. It was called the Glen Point Marriott in New Jersey. It's called the Gunpoint Marriott. Like, it's in the middle of nowhere. They'd go off to this.
Well, the rink was an exit.
Right, but
the rink was 16.
But the Glen Point Marriott was even further away than that. And so Igor Larionov sits down. It's his first year with the team, and he orders a glass of wine with dinner. And don't do that. He's like, I'm 38 years old. I'm having a glass of wine with dinner. Like, I don't care. And Liz's like, we don't. I am.
Mm-hmm. And not concerned about it.
No.
But that was part of it, too. Jersey was a different place. I mean, it just was. It was...
Not many guys finished their careers there.
Well, can I tell you that the first Philadelphia Flyer... I believe the first Philadelphia Flyer to retire healthy was Bobby Clarke in a Flyers uniform.
A lot of guys left. Well, the Leafs, The Leafs have that. I mean, who was the last great Leaf to retire with the team?
Now, they traded everybody. That was Keith Allen's. Every one of those cup guys got traded.
That move.
That
was the famous story about. It's one of my favorite draft stories. Craig Button's dad, Jack, was the chief scout for Washington. And back in the day, the Flyers used to dump their old players on Washington.
And Pittsburgh.
Ed Snyder would put his arm around old man Poland, and he, like, Mel Bridgman and Bill Clement and all these guys were first round picks. But finally in 1982, the Capitals said enough. And they had the fifth pick of the draft that year, and they really wanted Ronnie Sutter. They really wanted Ronnie Sutter from Lethbridge. And with the fourth pick in the draft, the Flyers took him. Mm-hmm. And Jack Button slammed his hand on the table and said, I'll find out who the leak is of the Flyers. When I find out who it is, you're done in this game. Take the next guy on our list. Scott Stevens.
Yeah, he was just fine.
Yeah, he turned out okay.
He was just fine. So Abe Polen, P-O-L-L-E-N, was the spelling of his name, right?
No, P-O-I-L-A-N. Oh,
no, I think
P-O-I-L-A-N, I think. Now I got to look it up.
Anyway, my first year in Washington, we had a little celebrity golf outing before the season started. And I remember some people being around the hole, and they introduced Dave Poulin. And they didn't catch the Dave part. And people were looking at me saying, wow, he's really young to be the owner of the team.
And he's not dressed that well. It is Pollin. You're right. Yeah. I think that in today's world, I mean, literally, I was going to say it before, literally, an NHL player can go on the road and never see a member of the public.
Yes.
The bus pulls up to the back of the hotel. Mm-hmm. You go back, you know, the bus goes under the arena, into the arena.
And the charter at the airport.
The charter at the airport. Like, you almost never see.
You're not going through the terminal.
Like, why are they wearing, I mean, mm-hmm. and the first thing players do when they get off on the plane is get that suit, get the jacket off, get the tie.
Yeah, I didn't mind it because guys pushed it. If you tried to go in another direction, guys pushed it to a level that you couldn't see. It was just simple.
We had a guy here. The first president of TSN didn't like brown suits. Couldn't wear a brown suit.
That's great.
Why? You can't tell someone what color there's. You hang on a second.
The boss didn't like him. I have no issue with that.
But it's not his decision.
Apparently it was.
No one was going to cross. So for the first...
So you'd go to the tailor, and the tailor would put all the brown suits. No,
for the first 5 years, we wore those Ted Baxter blazers, like the TSN light bulb logo on them. I've still got my original one. And then
it's going to be a collector's item, by the way.
Then they let us wear suits. Then we could wear our own suits. But they had to be blue, black, or gray.
My closet would fit very well.
David, we're grown men.
That's what I like. That's what I like.
That's fine. Then you wear that.
That's what I wear.
This is like Wimbledon telling everyone they have to wear white. It's ridiculous.
I don't mind tradition. It's the 21st. I don't mind tradition. I don't mind structure. And yes, I agree with you. It is the 21st century. So
let people make their own choices on things that have nothing to do with their ability to work.
Well, I want them to make their own choices on the ice within the structure.
My father-in-law, just before we go, my father-in-law worked for a brokerage house in the 60s where your choices of suits were black or dark gray. Mm-hmm. And so he was at a Leaf playoff game, and the Leafs scored in overtime to win the game. And there was the short side glass at the Gardens. He jumped over the glass because the players left the ice and grabbed the puck and held it up in the air. And the next day, so the Toronto Star didn't publish till the next day afterwards, and there was a picture of him on the front page with the puck. And he was called into the boss's office, said, young Mr. Bowen, that's not how we behave around here.
Wrong colored suit?
No, I don't think so. Well, maybe he was wearing a light
gray
suit.
Picture.
When we come back, Don Granato, assistant coach for the Buffalo Sabres, long time with the U.S. National Team Development Program. Of course,
Austin Matthews coach,
also you know, a member of hockey's royal family in the USA. Tony Granato and his sister Cammy is a Hockey Hall of Famer, married to our Ray Ferraro.
You get into family discussions about who the best player was.
Well, Riley and Reese Ferraro's parent is, you know, they're the child of a hockey legend, and Ray wasn't bad either. So we'll talk to Donnie Granato when we come back. You're listening to Overdrive on TSN 1050 on the TSN app and on TSN 4. It's Overdrive on TSN 1050. Gordon Miller, Dave Poulin, sitting in for Brian Hayes. I am. You're sitting in for O-Dog and Noodles.
Probably more Noodles than O-Dog.
You could be outrageous in your time. You're quietly outrageous.
On a relative basis to
you
that.
You just say quietly outrageous things. He's more over the top about it. One of my favorite people in the game is Donnie Granato, who's joining us now. He's going to be part of the Team Snap Hockey Coaches Conference taking place at Ryerson University in Toronto here July 18th to 20th. It's an all-star collection of Rickard Granberg, the Swedish national team coach, Bob Bugner's coming, Peter DeBoer, Todd Woodcroft, who's a Jets assistant coach, one of the bright young minds in the game, a whole host of people, including Donnie Granato, who, of course, is a part of the great Granato USA Hockey family. His brother Tony, a longtime NHL player, head coach at Wisconsin. His sister Cammy, a gold medalist for Team USA in women's hockey in the first women's hockey competition in the Olympics in Nagano in 98. She, of course, is married to our Ray Ferraro. Is Donnie there? Oh, he's calling him now. Okay, well, I had that big intro for him, and we got to wait a minute to get him on. But Don Granato was the first one to tell me how good Austin Matthews was.
Yeah, well, I had a lot of chats with him through his time there, and he said he's different.
He was coaching the National Team Development Program.
He was.
For those who don't know, the United States takes their top under-17 and under-18 players, now in Plymouth, Michigan, used to be Ann Arbor, Detroit suburb, and they hothouse them there. And so Austin Matthews played there, set all kinds of scoring records. But
right when he arrived, it was it was almost instant for Donnie. We'll get him to tell the story about how he talked to Austin's dad and said, you have to be prepared for the next 24 months because your son is going to be that much of an impact. Of course, he only played there the 1 year, and then he went to Switzerland for the year before the draft. But he was that. And think of the talent that's gone through that program. And, you know, from Patrick Kane on down to all the way through, you know, elite, elite players. Jack Eichel just before Matthews. And yet he felt right when he saw Austin Matthews with the group that he was different.
And he was right. And I think the one thing he talked about was Matthews' combination of size and skill. That kind of skill at that size is just so rare to find.
And the drive that he plays with, and he just saw it as different. I mean, we've still got more to see with Austin Matthews. Clearly,
what more?
I think that the grit and sandpaper will grow with the confidence of the person.
You're talking about defensive player, or just generally
all the way around. I think he'll engage more physically than he has. I think he'll learn to do that.
So the shoulders don't bother you? He's hurt both shoulders?
I think he will engage more just through age and through experience. How to engage more on his terms. I think I don't know what his upside is. You know, I don't know.
Well, this side is pretty good.
It's really good. It's really good.
Well, the man who called that shot is with us now, Don Granato, now an assistant coach of the Buffalo Sabres. Don, thanks for coming on with us.
Hi, Gord. My pleasure. What did I call? What shot?
Austin Matthews. I remember you telling me how good Austin Matthews was the fall 2 years before he was drafted.
Yeah, it wasn't hard to see for me anyway as a coach. You're sensitive to... Dave will tell you, you're very sensitive to the qualities that matter, and it's not, you know, everybody's wowed by the skill, you know, flipping a puck, shooting a puck, skating fast. But it's those burning, you know, those intangibles that add up to make Patrick Kane great, Austin Matthews, you know, all the great players have lots of intangibles. And he had it at a young age, that's for sure.
And Dave Poulin just made the comment that he thinks there's more room to grow for Austin Matthews. Do you agree with that?
I agree completely. You watch him and you just... He's so athletically gifted. He's so athletically talented that in our sport is one, there's so many different skill attributes to our sport. You know, every hockey player knows if you take a week off, your skills, you go back on the ice and you're like, oh my God, I got to get back at it. You know, there's so many skills that are in the game that will fall off just days after you stop training them. So flip that to the other side, which means you're never going to be able to master all of them. But when you have an athlete like Austin is, there's always room to get better. And then you couple that with his competitive fire to do just that. You've got the perfect dynamics, involved in that. So, you know, he will get better, I'm sure. Through his career. He'll keep adding to his game through his career, and that makes it exciting for everybody that's watching him.
Donnie spent 4 years with the National Development Program, then a year at the University of Wisconsin, and then back to the pro game, 2 years with the Hawks and now with the Sabres. What drew you back into the NHL at that point?
Very simple. A guy named Joel Quenneville. That was tough to leave Tony at Wisconsin. I had a conversation with Joel when he was looking, you know, to add a coach to his staff. I had worked with Joel in St. Louis for 5 or 6 years. I was the American League head coach while he was the head coach of the Blues. So a quick conversation with Joel, I was pretty excited. Tony was very excited as well because Tony had a chance to work with Joel in Colorado with the Avalanche. So very tough decision to leave Wisconsin, very easy decision to jump on board with Chicago with Joel there.
And what about the challenge now in Buffalo? Because you're jumping into a situation there where – you know, the Sabres have underperformed in recent years, and fans are getting impatient. The media is getting impatient. That's going to be a hot seat there.
It is. Our business is there's a lot of hot seats in our business, isn't there, Gord? No question. It's a great. The things that I love about it are we have some, you know, incredible. We started talking about Austin Matthews. You know, I had a chance to work with Jack Eichel, and he was every bit as exciting to work with and to be around every day. you know, I could, whatever I said about, started with Austin, ditto with Jack. You know, Ikes has an abundance of athleticism and skill. He's already extremely effective at the NHL, but there is no limit to what he can reach, really. And then I'm very excited you add that with Rasmus Dahlin in the back end, and a bunch of other young players. And I think we have a great mix here in Buffalo. And obviously coming from Chicago, you know, that was, you know, that had some different challenges. You know, it was a three-time Stanley Cup championship team that was in a transition phase. And, you know, those are very, very difficult because you're trying to gauge, okay, what do we let go of that we're very, very successful at and turn the page on? And what might we hold on to? We're just kind of going through a storm here. And so you're searching for a new identity, but your identity was so darn strong, you know, with winning three cups. Here is different, but exciting in the sense of these guys are hungry. There's no, do we hold on to anything? It's full go. You know, they, and you talk to the players, I'm meeting players one by one. Each guy I talk to here in Buffalo with the Sabres, you walk away from the conversation even more excited because they believe. So,
Don Granato is with us now on the Maple Toyota Hotline. How do you get players? And I know, Donnie, I've watched your teams for years, and I know that you let them do their thing offensively, but you do ask them to be responsible defensively and to stick within a structure. How do you get talented offensive players, many of whom have had things their own way for a long time? How do you get them to buy into that structure?
It's a process. It's a process. It's one that I loved. I loved going back, as Dave said at the outset, I spent 5 years at the national team program, and you get the best players in the country who never had to worry about systems. They just beat everybody in Bantam hockey and youth hockey with their skill. So they didn't have to pay attention in the coaches' meeting. If they gave up a goal, they just go back out on the ice and they score a goal back. So now you put them together and they're raw and from the standpoint of team systems. So you're trying to implement team systems because we played those kids right away out of Bantam hockey in the U.S. Junior League. So they went from Bantams, they skipped midget, and they're in the USHL with no veteran players. So you learn a lot of tricks to implementing systems, whether it be, and the tricks are, you know, how much, you don't have time. You're always, as a coach, limited on time. So how much do I need to do it in practice, in a drill, a forecheck drill? Could I do that instead on the dry marker board, or could I do it in a video session? So you're gauging, okay, how do I implement the system I want that in a position, or it's as efficient as you can where it's not taxing on the player? My 5 years back at the national team and running 100 practices a year or more than that with that talent really helped me streamline that and became a lot of fun. And, you know, real quick, one thing I would never do with them was talk about defense. You know, that's a turnoff to guys. you know, yeah, but you can, believe me, you can implement an awful lot not worried about what you implement.
And you're joining Ralph Krueger now, which, you know, was an out-of-the-box hire by Jason Botterill in Buffalo. And how far back do you go with Ralph, or how well do you know Ralph?
Well, I've gotten to know Ralph. Ralph, you know, we talked for the first time a couple of months ago. He had done some research on me and knew my background pretty well going into that conversation. And then we took the first conversation and just said, hey, let's discuss this and see where it may lead. If it leads where both of us would like to talk further, let's do that. And it was pretty quick, and he invited me into Buffalo to sit down with him. From that point, things were pretty quick and smooth. You know, we share a lot in common. I think we, from the side of even just sheer competitiveness, desire to win and you know, focus on that, but history of experience and whatnot. So it was really, you know, it's a newer relationship, but you know how the hockey world is. There's a lot of familiarity through mutual friends, and a lot of mutual friends.
Donnie, you're one of my favorite people to talk to at the rink, and so is Tony. And I think it's because the three of us have something in common. We all fight to get a word in edgewise with Ray Ferraro, your brother-in-law. How did you take it when you found out that Cammy and Ray were getting married?
great. you know, I mean, he is the funnest thing, Gord, after the fact, after they get married, is every rink I go in, and you think of the last staff I was with Kevin Dineen, Joel Quinville, and Paul Samuelson.
All the Hartford guys.
Oh. Yes, and so over the years, it's always great to add, you know, I've been very fortunate to have Tony as a brother, Cammy as a sister, and now Ray as a brother-in-law, because my life, my experiences through hockey just tripled or quadrupled, because I'm so close to them, and you hear stories about them, and people want to talk hockey with you that you don't even know because they know Ray or Tony. So it's been a blast, and I know you want some dirt and some things. I think the funnest thing is when you get Tony in the same room with Ray, because they can be cordial for about 5 minutes, and then they can't wait to dig each other.
When they played against each other, they hated each other.
Oh, I can only imagine.
They hated each other when they played against
great.
Each other.
Yeah, there is no question they hated each other. Everybody hated Tony and everybody hated Ray. So, of course, when they got together, and I'm talking about the oppositions. So when they get together, they can give it to each other pretty good. But it's all in fun, that's for sure. And it's certainly fun to be around it.
I'm amazed. You know, Donnie, you've been in the game a long time, and I don't see you have many bad days at the rink. And I know you're speaking at this Team Snap Hockey Coaching Conference. What's your message to young coaches that are listening about coming to the rink every day?
Yeah, you have to do what we do for the right reasons. You know, I my whole career wanted to move up. I want to coach at the highest level. You're a competitive guy. Your goal is to coach at the highest level. But for me, you just got to have faith that you're gonna move yourself and your career along, but immerse and engage in what you're doing day to day to try to do it the best for the players. We're kind of, as a coaches, I always look at it, we're in the service business, and we really have to divert our energy and commit our energy to the players and the assistant coaches and the team around here. You know, you watch the teams that win, and you see great enthusiasm, great synergy, and I really think that's the key for that. Now, that said, you know, the coaching positions, especially at the youth hockey, are a lot of times a grind and thankless position. You know, you've got to, when you put five guys out on the ice, people read that the other 15, you just told them they're not good enough. That's not true. But they think that way. That's the first reflex response is, you know, and so every decision you're making, you're throwing five guys out. Well, the reflex is the other 15 and their parents and family say, well, he doesn't like them. He doesn't like my guy. So the pressure today on coaches and the pressure today on people, the players, everybody else, that's the way our society is even greater. It's greater just in the 20-some years I've been coaching. You can see that. So a lot of my discussion, you know, my topic is more on how do you connect and deal with and move talented athletes along within the team dynamic and team framework. And again, I've had a lot of experience with that, thankfully, gratefully, for the national team program. So I'm excited to talk about it. I've talked about it a lot, and this will be another great forum to do it in.
How do you address the challenge of not overcoaching to young players? Because I think we went through a phase, even at the highest level, where the game in parts is overcoached.
Absolutely. And I will say this. Now, you know, systems, everybody wants it and talks and, you know, wants to be creative with systems. And you go to the coaches conference a lot of times and coaches talk systems and forechecks and backchecks. I will guarantee you that any system you want to run will run better with better skill. So if you keep developing your skill, whatever you want to implement, it's going to be implemented faster and quicker with better skill. And players are going to be able to do it with better skill. So especially at the youth hockey level, I've never left the youth hockey rink and said, oh my God, that team's systems were unbelievable. I haven't done it. I've been to thousands of youth hockey games. I've never seen a game where it really, really came down to systems, certainly with any consistency. You know, it's talent and it's execution. You know, so fatigue is a bigger factor than systems when you go to these games, you know. So here we are, you know, as a coach, you want to, you know, talk systems, implement systems. That's great. You can do it. but those aren't and really shouldn't be your bread and butter.
Donnie, thanks so much for talking to us. I can't wait to see you back at the rink in Buffalo this year.
I look forward to it also, Gordon.
And that's Don Granato.
Take care, Donnie. Good luck.
Join us on the Maple Toyota Hotline. Red Tag Days are back. Purchase any new vehicle, get a $500 gift certificate to Appliance Canada. Plus, get rates from 0%. Visit MapleToyota.com. Love the Granato family.
Yeah, it's a great family. I competed teams against them when they were at Wisconsin, obviously. And then Donnie used to come down and work at my hockey school at Notre Dame. And tied in. This is a great hockey family.
What kind of GPA do you need to get into the Notre Dame hockey school? Do you have to have like the high GPA?
Yes.
Tough school to get into. I call the games there. The only way I can get to Notre Dame is to call the games there. 5:45, rather. We'll be back in a moment on Overdrive on TSN 1050, the TSN app, and on TSN 4. Overdrive, TSN 1050, just past 5:50 here in Toronto. Major League Baseball players making some noise this week at the All-Star Game about their collective bargaining agreement, which expires at the end of next season, saying that they want changes and they're prepared to go to the wall to get them. And the thing they don't like is the control teams have over players at the start of their career.
It's remarkable.
So Clayton Kershaw making the point that now analytics are saying, you know, you don't want to pay players when they're older. So they're saying, well, then pick your poison. The other thing they didn't like was, you know, Vladimir Guerrero this year starting the year in the American or in AAA as opposed to being on the big league roster. And the same thing with Peter Alonso, the All-Star home run, the All-Star Derby champion, the home run derby champion, same thing last year. Wasn't called up in September.
So years of control.
Right. So you went, once you enter the big leagues, they've got you for 7 years.
And generally you enter the big leagues later than the other sports.
Now arbitration does become part of that.
Your arbitration through the 7 years.
Yeah, I think after year five, right? You're eligible for arbitration.
It's number of games as well.
Right. So, but the point they're making is, and baseball players have been more unified than any other professional athletes. You can argue they've come out ahead in all their work stoppages.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, whereas hockey players have eaten a bad sandwich every time they've gone out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They've pay cuts, salary caps, you name it. And, of course, baseball is the only one of the big four sports that doesn't have a salary cap. Do you admire the way baseball players have been militant about this stuff over the years and have held their ground?
They've done a great job. They really have. Now, they've paid a price for it as well with full work stoppages.
Mm-hmm. Lost seasons.
Yeah, lost seasons. And yet they've battled through. This is what Alex Anthopoulos and I used to talk about the most was he questioned why hockey gave up control that they actually had collectively bargained. Because in hockey, similar to baseball, you actually do control the first 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you get arb rights through your fourth and fifth year.
Mitch Marner has no leverage beyond withdrawing his services.
He doesn't have arbitration rights.
No arbitration rights. He can't. I mean, he could sign an offer sheet or withdraw his services. Those are the only two pieces of leverage he has. Which kind of makes it funny that people, you know, rip on him for asserting his rights. He doesn't. He doesn't have a contract.
Doesn't have a contract. But Alex Anthopoulos, you think of Josh Donaldson winning the MVP and yet still being under control.
Yeah.
And I think Mike Trout was one of the first to get the big contract well before the control was up.
Right.
And it just, in hockey, it goes back to 2007 and the offer sheet to Dustin Penner that started to take away the control in the second contract.
And so what the NHL would say to executives is you have lots of tools to use. It's up to you. If you choose not to use your leverage, that's up to you. But when the player has leverage, they always use it.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the age-old argument. I mean, it really is. And Mitch Marner doesn't have leverage per se at all.
Nor does Rantanen or Point.
No,
or
this
Kachuk,
entire group doesn't.
Any of them, except if the team struggles without them.
But sports watch other sports. You can see baseball guys saying, wait a second, these guys are getting paid
right. Their
third year. After their third year, they're getting home run contracts on a relative basis to the salary structure in their league. Why aren't we?
Coming up in the third hour, we'll talk to Milt Stegall, our TSN CFL analyst, about what's going on in that league, including what's going on with the Argos, who are awful. And we'll talk more about what's going on around the sport world today, including the death of Jim Bouton, who wrote Ball 4, the groundbreaking sports tell-all book. You're watching or listening to Overdrive on TSN 1050, watching on TSN 4, and on the TSN app.